Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Life is changing in Australia
because the pub is shut.
Sucked in, fellas.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
I will call it a personal nightmare.
Tell the Prime Minister to go and get...
It is changing all around the world.
I accept your nomination.
The authority is total.
And I rejected that approach.
It's all about acknowledging how far we've come.
He's all tip and no iceberg.
Like a really scary wooden puppet.
He was drunk.
That's not true.
Not now, not ever.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant. You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
G'day, Mark Kenny here from the ANU's Australian Studies Institute. In this episode, we're going to be talking about China, about climate change, and about the post-Trump strategic competition in the Indo-Pacific. If you're like me, you'll have thought about these issues a lot in recent years and found yourself lurching from hope to despair. Sometimes you can see a way forward, and at other times the forces seem so great and unstoppable as to be beyond us. It's been said that America can always be trusted to do the right thing, but only after it's exhausted all the other options. That pretty much sums up its pandemic debacle right there. On Monday, Kevin Rudd was quoted in a hopeful piece by Nick O'Malley in The Herald, discussing the possibility of China stepping up its effort to curb emissions. The Asian Colossus is the world's largest offender, accounting for 28% of global greenhouse gas emissions, almost double the US on 15%. You don't have to trust China to do the right thing by the world, for example, as Kevin Rudd says. You just have to trust China to be China. His is part of a growing view that China's leadership recognises that its own interests are threatened by runaway climate volatility and that the Chinese Communist Party's grip on power could be vulnerable to challenge if the problem of unlivable cities is not addressed. Then, of course, there's the geostrategic challenge to US dominance from an expansive China, particularly in this region. To discuss these matters, it's welcome back to Yun Zhang, who is editor of the China Story blog at the Australian National University, and she's also director of China Policy Centre. You may have seen her recently on an episode of Four Corners, one by Stan Grant, in which he did a fascinating profile of President Xi Jinping. Welcome back, Yun.
Hello.
And it's welcome back also to Dr. Graham Smith, who is, among other things, a fellow in the Department of Pacific Affairs at the ANU's Coral Bell School of Asia-Pacific Affairs, a noted China scholar and co-host with Louisa Lim of the Little Red podcast. Welcome back to you, Graham.
Thanks, Mark.
Ewan, let me start with you. That Four Corners episode on President Xi was a portrait of an increasingly powerful and, I suppose you'd say, autocratic style of leadership of a man who is really forming China in his own image, in a sense. What did you make of the overall picture that came across? I guess I'm asking you to comment on a program that you were part of, but
that I haven't seen.
Oh, that's right, because you don't like to look at your own interviews.
Yes. If there's a function where it just blacks out when I appear on TV, then I will watch that.
But nonetheless, I suppose the logic for doing it, for doing the program, is that the world is increasingly concerned about the direction of things in China. The sense really lost some time ago now that it was going to liberalize in some sort of way along with its economic growth. That seems to have gone by the wayside. And so now we're looking at, well, who is Xi Jinping? He's made himself president for life, effectively. He occupies a number of senior positions now that have previously been distributed with others. So it's a concern for the world that that we see this direction in China, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So there is a lot of hope for China, even when Xi Jinping first came to power. The hope was that China, along with economic liberalization, would also undergo political liberalization, political reform, and turning towards more democratic system of governance. And we're seeing that that has not happened. In fact, under Xi Jinping, the reverse has happened. So while Xi Jinping is still going through some economic reform and liberalization, the track on political reform has not gone through the same way. Xi Jinping has become more autocratic or more authoritarian. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of comparison between Xi Jinping to Mao Zedong. One of them was about around cult of personality. And there is a lot of language, similar language has been used as well. The helmsman, the people's leader, all this is harkening back to Mao era, which was not a great time for China, to be honest. Although for CCP's historical narrative, it was a good time. But I think for most people in China's time, you know, there was a lot of starvation, a lot of political turmoil. People died from political struggles. So it was not a great time. But now that she seems to be imitating a lot of what Mao is doing, at least with regards to cult of personality. And that is concerning. And for people outside China, it is important that we do understand China's leadership, where they came from, and the trend is going. When we want to understand the country, it is important that we also understand its domestic imperatives.
Yes, particularly when they are so clearly shaped by one person or by one party and by one dominant figure within that party, which is Xi Jinping. Graham, there was a real sense when in the earlier days of his leadership that that he was going to be a liberaliser. There was in Australia in particular, I remember covering this as a journalist and travelling to China with prime ministers and being in close proximity to him. And there was a narrative that was being run that Xi Jinping had spent time in Australia. He had a particular fondness for Tasmania, that he was very much a kind of a modern leader. And that's kind of over recent years just ebbed away quite decisively, hasn't it?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, even Yoon's friend Eric Abetz was getting extremely cuddly with Xi Jinping in Tasmania and getting very excited about a free trade agreement that Tasmania signed with China. You won't see Eric talking much about that these days.
No.
But certainly it was a big surprise. And harking back to the Four Corners program, I know Yoon hasn't watched it, but the most interesting thing for me was the pro-regime guest that they had was talking up Xi Jinping as the most powerful man in the world. Now, that's new. Like before, it was always like, no, we're a rising power, we're a developing nation. But to have a government-approved guy going on Australian TV and saying, this guy is number one in the world, that's a huge change.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because, yeah, as you say, it used to be about kind of all those things you just listed and, you know, the sentence often finished with, you know, China is respectful, that it understands its place, it understands the sovereign rights of other countries. And yet now you don't really see that so much. I mean, lip service is paid to it from time to time, but it's all about assertiveness now. It's all about that statement, as you say, the most powerful man in the world.
Yeah. It's quite interesting that in recent Xi Jinping speeches, including the one on poverty elimination recently, she has basically airbrushed Deng Xiaoping out of the picture. Mm. And Deng was known as, you know, the pragmatism kind of person who, you know, support the policy of hide your capability and bide your time. And she basically just airbrushed him out of the picture and now China is powerful, and also there's a more focus on ideology rather than pragmatism under Deng as well.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And do you think that this all points, as I guess we all worry it does, towards more decisive action like the regaining of Taiwan, for example?
Well, Taiwan is a very tricky issue. Certainly, the rhetoric of regaining Taiwan has always been there, even before Xi Jinping. The CCP has always maintained that Taiwan is part of its territory. And that it will take whatever is necessary to basically reclaim the territory. So in that sense, it hasn't really changed under Xi. But certainly there are changes happening now. One of them is that there is a more nationalist sentiment in China, in mainland China, but also on Taiwan, people's identity is changing towards Taiwanese identity rather than one that's also Chinese. So I think that will make the CCP leadership really think carefully about whether and when they're going to take some actions. But I think war, well, if we're talking about hot war, that's still quite unlikely.
Yeah, I'm not so sure. I mean, I was very much unconvinced until recently. But if you look at the language that's being used by the PLA, this talk of America as the strong enemy and explicitly talking about America with this very, very loaded term that most of Xi's predecessors avoided using. And if you look at their military capability, part of the reason why it wasn't likely in the past is they just weren't able to retake Taiwan. But militarily now, if you talk to analysts, they are capable of doing so and they could do so tomorrow without too much bother. But, you know, will they take that step? And a lot of fairly sane analysts, like, you know, people like Oriana Scalamastro and even Gaddy Epstein, although whether Gaddy's sane is a question for another time, are saying it will happen within the end of Xi Jinping's open-ended term. And they look at this every day and I'm kind of like, gosh, you know.
Which is sort of a time frame of realistically of 5 to 10 years, yep. Presumably. And then, of course, the question, I mean, Yun used the term hot war, that, you know, if it's done militarily, if it's done by an invasion, it raises the question about what the US does. The US policy is sort of what strategic ambiguity, I think, is one way of describing it. I think Joe Biden has recently sort of emphasized that America is – remains absolutely committed to its position on Taiwan. It's just that it's not entirely clear what its position on Taiwan is.
Yeah.
So well, it's absolutely committed to this vague position.
Well, it will have to be committed. It's one of the deterrence effect. If you just say that, oh, we're not committed to Taiwan, then you just lose all the deterrence. So, of course, us United States, at least in public, would have to be committed to the defense of Taiwan. Whether that will happen, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, the one positive for the world is we have a slightly more predictable US part of the equation. And there were signals within the Chinese military that they were half expecting Trump to go to war in the latter half of 2020 as kind of a wag the dog scenario to rally the nation around him. Now, look, thankfully he didn't, and he was true to his isolationist rhetoric. But the fact that they were seriously getting ready for America to launch some kind of preemptive attack against them is incredible, while at the same time, you know, kind of sending very mixed signals about Xinjiang and other places. So, you know, I think for the world, the upside is the US now, we can at least say, will be fairly predictable.
Yes, predictable, although we don't actually know what would happen. I mean, if this is a Xi Jinping ambition within the next 5 to 10 years, and perhaps it's in the earlier part of that window, who knows? I mean, I'm not predicting that, but we just don't know. He has mentioned it a number of times, and this is the thing. You made the point, Yun, that it's long been the Chinese Communist Party's position to regain Taiwan. That's Chinese policy. But it's the number of times that it's been mentioned, the rhetoric that's surrounding it. And as you say, you mix it together with that sense of growing nationalism that he has, stoked. It's potentially a situation that could. It's very conceivable that some sort of attempt is made.
I mean, Linda Jakobsen had a very convincing argument that they would do everything short of war, which is kind of where we are now. Mm-hmm. So, in terms of interfering with Taiwan's media, in terms of maybe shutting down the internet or the phone systems, just making life really, really difficult in Taiwan, but not physically invading. So, I think that's the scenario we should consider as well.
Yeah.
So you mentioned, Graham, about the sanity that now, you know, comparative sanity that now prevails.
Well, and they still launch missile strikes with very unclear justification. So no.
No, sorry. I was talking about the sanity on the other side of the Atlantic.
So was I.
Yep.
On the other side of the Pacific, perhaps. Anyway, let's go to the question of the US, because that is the big sort of change in the dynamic. We have, as you were saying, you know, China asserting itself now, very much seeing itself as the coming power, as the new big strategic noise, certainly in this region. And we have a return to kind of sensible, predictable policy in the US. What do you think that's going to produce in China? I suppose another way of looking at this is, was the sort of madness of Trump license for China to act more irresponsibly or to use more irresponsible language? And will the advent of the Biden administration bring about more sober relations bilaterally, do you think?
It's hard to see a huge shift. I think both nations are fairly set on their course. So even though we'll see more sanity from the US, it doesn't mean China won't still be looking to make incremental gains. And if you look at places like Vietnam, for example, where they didn't build an oil rig because of the threat from China, and when the US might have stepped in and said, no, you know, you can, that's your waters, you can drill there, they didn't step in. And that was, you know, Trump, of course, said nothing about this. But these sorts of encroachments on their neighbours, I think, are likely to continue. And what the Biden administration does about them is really something to watch, because that's where you could, you know, get potential friction or a flashpoint.
So the Biden administration has a renewed focus on human rights, and that's probably going to annoy China continually. It is also continuing with the strategy of competition, especially in technology. So that hasn't changed. What has changed possibly is rhetorics. I think the Biden administration is unlikely to provoke China unnecessarily, like what the Trump administration has done. But competition is going to continue. There's no stopping that. China and United States are both great powers, and as great powers, they will continue to compete. And that's going to result in some kind of conflict of interest. But Biden is going to, I think, you know, when we talk about return to normal foreign policy, the Biden administration probably will look to its allies and partners and work with them more. Now, on the one hand, that's probably a good thing, to bring more of a multilateral approach to managing China. But on the other hand, it could also mean that they are going to look to allies and partners to do more. Yeah. And that could be difficult for some countries. We know that a lot of countries in Asia do not want to choose between China and the United States. In fact, you know, when we're talking about a normal US foreign policy, from Australia's perspective, that's probably a good thing. But from a lot of people in the global South, in Asia, in Africa, they see United States not as a really a positive light on the hill as perhaps people in the Western countries do. And they just see there's two great powers and they don't want to be pulled into either of them. So when they try to play them off each other and try to gain the maximum leverage from it, but they don't want to be seen to be, you know, getting too close to either side. And that's probably a wise strategy for those countries as well.
One thing I found fascinating about Trump is that he had this idea that China was something he knew something about. Mm-hmm. And Matt Bevin, who does Russia, Are You Listening? had this wonderful tip to go back and look at his 2016 speeches. And in these early rallies, he's doing his, you know, his sort of build the wall, getting the crowd whipped up.
Yeah.
But then he goes on these massive digressions about China as a currency manipulator, and this is a big problem, and you've all got to listen. And basically, he was losing his base. You know, they're just like, what's he on about? Like, currency manipulator? What are these words? And after a while, he just kind of dropped it. But it was interesting at the outset. He sort of was very China-focused because he saw this as a problem that, one, he understood, and two, that he thought he could fix.
Let's take a quick break there, and when we come back, let's sort of take this into the dimension of climate change, because that's obviously going to be a big theatre for bilateral relations as well between these two poles, between the US and China.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
All right, welcome back. Now, let's think about climate change. It's obviously a major preoccupation of the new Biden administration. It's increasingly preoccupation right around the world, except in Australia, apparently.
Not in Australia.
Kevin still cares.
Now, plenty of people care. Yes, we do seem to be have been dragging the chain a bit on that, and it's going to be fascinating to see what the implications are for Australia of these series of meetings that are going to be happening this year and how that plays out. But before we get to any of that, just want to, in thinking in terms of what we've been discussing, the relations between the US and China, the competition, the areas in which that plays out. In one area, a very important area of climate change, both, it seems, there are signs, are looking for some level of cooperation. Now, they did come together and cooperate to some extent in the lead up to the 2015 UN climate talks, and that's what unlocked effectively the progress that we saw with the Paris Accord and the like. And there is a great emphasis on this from Biden. He's appointed John Kerry as his as his climate envoy, given him cabinet level position. There's a corresponding Chinese appointment now. So I suppose this raises a couple of questions. Will there be progress between these two countries on climate change? And could climate change as a forum, you know, as a sort of a field for dialogue, also aid in other ways in terms of the bilateral relationship? Yun?
I think climate change is quite possibly one area where there could be a lot of cooperation between China and the United States. It is also one area of competition, but competition is not necessarily a bad thing. So we see, for example, with regards to vaccine diplomacy, that countries vying for influence is trying to supply vaccines to the global south, to poor countries. And that probably means those countries get earlier access to vaccines. And I think that similar things could happen with climate change. As countries vying for influence, especially in the Pacific, where concerns about climate change is very high, that could lead to a lot of, for example, technology development, helping countries to mitigate the effects of climate change. So in that sense, in climate change, competition may not be necessarily a bad thing. Cooperation is another way. It is possible also for two countries to come together and cooperate on climate change. I think, you know, Xi Jinping recently was quite big on net zero emissions.
Mm-hmm.
one thing we know that domestically, you know, issues with ecology, issues with pollution is high on people's mind. And I think to reflect that, China will be quite willing to do things in an international forum to help their domestic narrative as well.
It's really fascinating, Graham, because this area, because it's been widely noted that it was a surprise that China announced the net zero by 2060 target. There is some speculation that that will be toughened up at some point. But cynics point out that China's also building coal-fired power stations. The provinces are getting money and they are they're being financed to build coal-fired power stations at a great rate of knots. So there's an inconsistency here. But there are also signs that this is coming to an end as well. A lot of the capacity of there's a great deal more capacity than there is demand for a lot of the electricity that's being developed here. There's talk that there's not a lot of due diligence in terms of the financing of these things, that they're being done for sort of local political reasons or for economic stimulus reasons rather than necessarily to meet future energy needs. It's quite possible that we're going to see some quite serious kind of turns in policy in this space domestically in China, and that China will then seek to use that to leverage other countries.
Look, I don't think there's any doubt about that. And the reason why you can present both cases is you can easily point to serious data points in both directions.
Yeah.
Certainly coming out of the five-year plan, which has just been released. And what the five-year plan does essentially is it really kicks the can down the road to the end of the year when the energy sector makes its plans. Now, so the key figure, and I guess one that Kevin Rudd will be a bit disappointed in, is the reduction in energy intensity as a proportion of GDP. It used to be 15% and they've actually dropped the target to 13.5%, which is really surprising if you're talking big ambitions in 2060. The current ambitions have actually been reduced compared to 2015, 2020. Now, where that kind of leaves you climate change-wise is the problem the party has. If asked to choose between social stability and the environment, it's going to choose social stability every time. And if that means propping up local governments and providing employment, it will continue to do so.
That's quite right. If they have to choose between economic growth and concerns for the environment, definitely economic growth would predominate because of the stability it provides to the regime. But in the five-year plan, we are seeing there are some movements. Like the trend is towards more concerns for the environment. They talk about climate change, talking about high-quality growth rather than just focusing on gross growth figure. So the trend is definitely there. But I think over the next few years, China will try to balance a bit. It depends on how the economy is going. It will try to twinkle at the edges and look at the policy settings from there. Yeah.
And I can see, absolutely agree with you. Like, I think there are things in there, like there's a 25% target for renewables making up the energy mix by 2030, which is a great signal. The coal body has put a cap on the use of coal. I think it's still huge. It's like 4.2 billion tons, but still it's a cap, which is significant. But on the other side, if you look at the five-year plan, there's all this language which continues to talk about coal use. Like, it's not, coal is still in there. It's not, and when it's referred to, it's clean coal this, clean coal that. It's not, we're going to, get rid of it.
That's right. I think its strategy is trying to grow the green economy rather than necessarily trying to shrink the traditional economy.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see how well that works. There's not a lot of time. And, as the world's largest emitter, I guess the world's looking for more ambition than that. And it's going to be fascinating to see whether diplomacy from the US can have any effect on China in that regard, whether China can be shamed into or pressured into accelerating its ambition over time. Let's draw it back now to this region. There's a couple of interesting aspects of this. That is China's behavior in the region. There was a big controversy recently about this. This fishing, what was it, a fishing hub in PNG Island, not far north of Australia. What did you make of all of that, Graham?
Look, the fishing hub may happen. And paradoxically, it's more likely to happen as a result of the Australian government's reaction, because that has allowed the Chinese company, which is, you know, hasn't got any experience in Papua New Guinea at all, Zheng Hong Fishing Company, they, in many ways, have been able to leverage the Australian government's reaction to say, look, Chinese government, get behind us and back us. And so paradoxically, our somewhat overreaction to the likelihood of a fisheries hub being successfully built in Daru, which is the closest we have to just an open public health emergency in our region. I mean, they have drug-resistant tuberculosis completely out of control. So if you to have workers there, you would really need, you know, a serious public health campaign for years before it was viable to base workers there, because they'll get TB and they'll probably die. Or have early deaths as a result. So, you know, it's quite possible Zheng Hong hasn't done its due diligence before choosing the site, but certainly Australian government reaction has really, you know, helped their case in domestically.
Well, what did the Australian government say?
Well, they sent a delegation up to Daru to basically, you know, ask, hey, what's going on, guys? And at that point, they'd only signed an MOU, and anyone that's worked in the Pacific knows that these MOUs, you know, literally they just hand them out. You know, they don't mean anything. They just mean some people sat down together and said, hey, this would be a great idea. It doesn't mean any money has been put towards it as yet. It's almost something you do to show your bosses back home that, hey, I'm here in the Pacific and I'm doing things.
Yeah.
So
but there was talk of some sort of a city that would go around this, you know, that there would be, you know, tens of billions of dollars that would be ploughed into infrastructure to make this small.
Are you talking about the proposal from a company that's pretty much an unknown and very small company? Is that the one?
That's the one.
Okay.
$39 billion, I think the final figure was. I think, you know, I don't know if there's a number close enough to zero that I can, you know, put on that, but it's that one is not going to happen. I mean, it's up there with the $100 billion
loan. But it certainly
attracted
some interest, some headlines. And to your point, it probably increased the profile of the fishing hub project there.
Yep, it puts them on the map.
Yeah.
I think that really just showed more that Australia's anxiety about China rather than anything else, to be honest, because that city project was never going to happen. But the fact that someone did a proposal attracts so much media attention, so much anxiety in Australia, really say something about Australia.
Yeah, and from the perspective of the Chinese state, there's no downside to it. I mean, the project might not go ahead, but what it allows them to do is say, look, there's this place in your former colony. You're not investing a cent in it. It's a complete disaster. We, China, will step in and do what you should have done decades ago. So there's really no downside for them rhetorically.
This fits into that overall kind of narrative about the Pacific, about China moving in, about China funding infrastructure projects in Pacific Islands, about Australia, you know, this is our backyard rather than China's backyard. How much is that shaping how much did that shape the Australian government's response, even though, as you say, Ewan, it was a pretty sort of unquantified story, that one about the city around the fishing hub and so forth, but it all fits into that narrative, right?
So that's right. Unfortunately, what we have is basically really bad cases of confirmation bias in a lot of media reporting around China. We're seeing things, you know, there are a lot of stories where China is doing this because it fits with our existing prejudices or understanding of China. It suddenly become a very big story, even when it's the credibility is still, or let's say there's no credibility at all in some of these stories. So that's very unfortunate. And, you know, when we think about our response to China, really should be based on a proper understanding of China's motives, incentives, how their system works, our knowledge. We should build better knowledge about China when we think about how to confront the challenges of rising China. But instead, a lot of media reporting we're getting is basically rubbish.
And how is that showing up in terms of perceptions of China from Australia, and what does that mean for example, Chinese Australians? There's recent work by Lowy Institute did a poll on this, and it shows some pretty worrying circumstances that Chinese Australians are living in.
That's right. The Lowy Report indicated that one in five Chinese Australians were physically attacked or threatened. And the two reasons that were nominated was one, the COVID, the fact that a lot of Australians were blaming the pandemic on people of Chinese heritage. And the second one was deterioration in the bilateral relationship. I've heard stories in Canberra, for example, there was a local politician that was of Korean heritage and was yelled at saying that she was a Chinese spy. So there's a sense that the deteriorating bilateral relationship has caused the increasing suspicion of Asian people in general, actually, not just the people of Chinese heritage. And people are basically punishing or putting blame on people of Chinese heritage that is in the community. That is, of course, not very great for social cohesion, and is going to lead to a lot of, anxiety, anxious, angst among people of Chinese heritage, and especially people, for example, Chinese international students, people that actually haven't been here for a while. They're going to see these rise incidents of racism, and they're probably actually going to feel more nationalistic as well as a result. So that's going to, again, inflame a lot of community tensions.
It's an interesting point, isn't it, Graham, that it actually kind of stokes nationalism in a perverse way, because obviously you're going to sort of pull within your grouping if you're being attacked for being a member of that grouping.
I mean, that's the irony, is the extremes on both sides embolden each other. That's the net result in both countries. So it's really kind of sad when you see Australian commentators, going on and really over-egging the whole United Front is everywhere thing. And, if it's everywhere, oh, gosh, it's even in that school that where they learn Chinese. So, it really can go to ridiculous lengths, and there are consequences for Australian Chinese, citizens. One thing that will have dismayed, I think, the Labor Party is, I think it was about 2-1, the Australian Chinese community were.
Yes.
I'd never seen the Liberal Party's vote above 40%, but it was above 40% in this poll. So, the Labor Party has very much lost Chinese Australians.
Yeah, yeah. It's strange that if I was a Liberal Party strategist, then I will be thinking, oh, I should get more Chinese immigrants to Australia. That will boost our support.
No, I don't know why your friend Eric is so down on it. But
Well, and it is kind of ironic when you think about it that this government has presided over, I'm not saying it's all Australia's fault, but has presided over a deterioration in the bilateral relationship that's probably sharper than any we can remember. And yet you have this approval amongst the Chinese community, 2-1, as you say, for this government. I mean, there are some pretty staunchly kind of anti-Chinese voices that you hear in the coalition government.
Yeah, interestingly, there was a recent study on WeChat, political stories on WeChat, and they've actually found that conservative voices during the last election, that is, conservative voices and articles that are more supportive of Liberal Party does much better on WeChat. There's more stories of them. I guess one thing is that a lot of people in the Chinese Australian communities are socially conservative. I think that's probably one of the reasons. And of course, while the bilateral relationship is important for, international relations scholars, to the ordinary everyday person, they're more interested in domestic issues.
Yeah, and the attitudinal component of that survey was fascinating as well. It basically showed, Chinese Australians are the perfect Australians because they care less about most issues than average Australians. The only one I think where they ticked above was less about climate change, less about, COVID, less about everything, except for refugees. And they were more concerned about refugees than the average Australian. So
that's fairly traditional amongst refugee groups, though, yes. Right, through history, isn't it?
That absolutely.
Refugee groups have tended to sort of want to pull up the ladder for
anyone coming. Right.
Absolutely.
How does it compare with attitudes in the region, in the Pacific, but also I suppose in the Southeast Asian region about China? Is your sense, Graham, that the same kinds of hostilities or suspicions about China exist amongst populations in countries in the region?
Look, it really depends on historical memories. And this is something that, Yun was alluding to earlier. Mm. If a country has a favorable historic experience with China, they'll tend to be favorably disposed. So Southeast Asia and the Pacific are immediately completely different because Southeast Asia has been enmeshed with China for, well, centuries, whereas the Pacific, in terms of the Chinese state, they've really only met the Chinese state since the 1970s and in earnest since probably 2006.
So is that code – I'm going to be cheeky here and say, is that code for if you haven't known them long, you're more likely to like them?
Well, if you're a Pacific elite, you're more likely to –
I mean, I'm talking about the state. I'm talking about the state here rather than Chinese people.
Look, absolutely. And I mean, you know, the attitudes in Vietnam, the reason they're so entrenched is because they, you know, they date back literally thousands of years. And
there's a lot of grievances there.
A lot of historical grievances that aren't going anywhere on either side. Mm. Whereas if you're in Tonga and, you know, you've had all very pleasant – if you're part of the royal family or the elite, you've had very pleasant experiences with the Chinese coming along and funding projects, then sure, you're likely to like them. But if you're a member of the community who's seen their shops, you know, basically taken over by Chinese migrants, you might have a very different view to the elites in your society.
So, Graham, one last question. Were you surprised by the SBS decision on its Chinese news?
Yeah, it was a surprise in terms of the speed which they made a decision. They'd only been presented with this report from Safeguard Defenders, which is an NGO that is basically looking at people who are, you know, sort of coerced within China, including forced confessions on Chinese television. Now, the UK broadcaster Ofcom didn't immediately act on these complaints. What they suspended CGTN's license for, that's the Chinese broadcaster who broadcasts abroad, what they suspended their license for was CGTN being a party-affiliated broadcaster. They didn't act on the Safeguard Defender complaints immediately.
Right.
Whereas SBS, within days, suspended the broadcast of Chinese news on its channel. So certainly the speed with which they acted is impressive. Now, whether that leads to the complete withdrawal is another thing. It's just been suspended.
Mm.
But, yeah, certainly I was very surprised how quickly they acted on these forced confessions.
I was also quite surprised by the speed. I remember a few years ago there was a complaint to SBS broadcast on Vietnamese news, I think it was. And SBS responded by putting a warning before every news bulletin broadcast, basically saying SBS does not endorse the content of this broadcast.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, if they did that already, I didn't predict that they will act so quickly this time around. But one interesting thing is that those news broadcast, news bulletin, they're half an hour news bulletin taken directly from foreign news channels. They broadcast very early in the morning. In case of this Mandarin news broadcast, it's 6:30. And I'm not sure how many people actually watch them, but I don't think that many people watch them anyway.
Right.
And from surveys of, Chinese the use of how Chinese Australians receive media, we know that most Mandarin speakers in Australia get their media from social media, such as WeChat, and not that many from TV, and definitely not that many from places like Xinhua or CCTV or CGTN. In fact, if you ask most people who are Mandarin speakers about what they think about these news bulletins, they probably tell you it's very, very boring. So I have watched them before. Basically, they're 20 minutes of what Xi Jinping's doing, followed by 10 minutes of what you actually call news.
Wow.
Pretty much most people will be just falling asleep watching them.
Yeah.
They're very, very unappealing to watchers. So although it is a big deal that SBS has suspended, I agree, the actual impact on people that watch them, probably not that much.
Yeah. I mean, it has changed a little bit. I mean, now it's sort of 10 minutes of Xi Jinping doing things, 10 minutes of America is in chaos, and then, you know, 10 minutes of
CCP's doing great.
So a lot of propaganda, basically.
Yeah, it pretty was. It's almost unwatchable. I mean, I absolutely agree with you. It's almost unwatchable. But it is the flagship thing, and it is something that the Chinese state will not be happy about. Even though no one watches it.
Well, so it's just another little thorn in the side, I suppose, happening in Australia.
Interestingly, CGTN came out with an announcement that says, we never allowed SBS to broadcast this in the first place.
All right. Oh, that is interesting.
But it's still on their website. I mean, this is the thing. They can't have it both ways. If you go to the CCTV4 website, they still have his forced confession up there online. You can watch it now if you like.
Mm. Well, there it is. Now, but that does raise one final question. I'm going to sort of put this is without notice to you. Right? The relationship, the bilateral relationship between Australia and China has, as we discussed, you know, gone into the sort of deep freeze. A year from now, will it be better or worse?
Worse. All the same. A recent speech by Wang Xining at the ACBAC dinner, which actually I was there, but then it got posted on the Chinese embassy website. I think that signals that China is definitely going to a more confrontational approach towards Australia.
Yeah, I would say worse. So why I don't agree with the proposition that Xi Jinping is the most powerful man in the world. He's sending out very strong signals to his subordinates, and the safest thing for them to do in terms of keeping their jobs is to be hawkish, and they will continue to be hawkish. And you know, the West will continue to respond in the way it's been responding. So I can only see a downward spiral.
Oh, on that cheery note, thanks very much, Yun Jiang and Graham Smith, two of the finest ANU has to offer. Thanks for spending a bit of time with us here at Democracy Sausage. It's always a pleasure to have you back. That's the podcast for this week, or at least for this early part of the week. I'll be back later in the week with a Democracy Sausage Extra. So until then, bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.